Chapter 5. For 5 days, no less, they simply went up and down the fine, spacious Great Bay, admiring the billows and fishing over the side. Delightful sailing indeed. And in the evening they played music until supper time or beyond. On the 6th day, misled by reports of a convoy coming up from Lorient, the inshore squadron sailed through the Passage du Raz once more and across the Bay of Audierne to the farther point where they lay to, and sent the Ringle round to look into the harbour and inlets farther south. Captain Aubrey had dined in the wardroom, a wardroom which on this occasion included the Bellona's surgeon, a member, of course, by right, and now he was standing on the poop, drinking coffee with William Harding, the First Lieutenant, Captain Temple of the Royal Marines, Mr. Paisley, the purser, a convivial soul, a great hand at whist, and always willing to play sentimental ballads on his viola while others sang, together with Stephen and a few others. "There, Doctor," said Jack, pointing to a truly dreadful reef half a mile on their larboard beam. "There are the pen marks."
"I've often heard them mentioned," said Stephen,
"always with strong disapprobation and even loathing. Scylla and Charybdis ain't in it with a strong southwester and a falling tide," said Jack. "Nor the Gorgonzola, and that's Penmark Head beyond. Lord, that must have been a rough, wild night of it," he added to Harding.
"Indeed it was, sir," said Harding. "I never wish to see such another."
"I don't suppose you do," said Jack. "Doctor, do you know about the Droit de l'Homme?" "A few things are more familiar to me than that amiable fiction. In my youth I wrote several versions, each more liberal than the last. In one I even included women, asserting that they were..." The sailors smiled indulgently, and the purser said, "He means the man of war, Doctor. A French 74. It was in the days of high revolutionary fervour in 96 or 97 when they gave ships names like that."
"The time of Hoche's expedition to Ireland," said Harding.
"That I remember," said Stephen, with a chill about his heart. And then, feeling that something more was called for, "Will you tell me about it, so?"
"Pray do," said the marine. "I was in India at the time."
"Well," said Harding, collecting his thoughts, "it began a little before Christmas of the year 96 here in Brest. The French had gathered 17 of the line, 13 frigates, 6 brig corvettes, 7 transports and a powder ship. We were aware of their motions, of course, although we couldn't tell where they were going. And Admiral Colpoys had a strong force off Ushant, while the inshore squadron was under Sir Edward Pellew in the Indefatigable 44. You remember, Doctor, that the Indefatigable was cut down from a 2-decker, and she was a heavy frigate carrying 24-pounders. I was a master's mate in her at the time. And under him he had 3 other frigates and a lugger. The Frenchmen came out, one after another, with a kindly east wind, 44 sail of them with something like 20,000 soldiers aboard, and they steered for the Passage du Raz to avoid Admiral Colpoys. But one struck on the Grand Stephen A just at the opening of the passage, and others went out by the Euroese, their admiral having changed his mind quite late in the day when dusk was falling. There was a shocking confusion of signals and lights and guns, but although Sir Edward sent to the Admiral and to Falmouth, they were never intercepted. Nope, they sailed on through fog and foul weather to Bantry Bay, where they had a perfectly appalling time of it, gale after gale, with ships driving from their anchors and being blown out to sea, frigates pitching forecastle under, foundering, impossible to land troops, food running out, and eventually most of them straggled back to France. There was a second rendezvous off the mouth of the Shannon. A few looked in, but only one stayed any length of time before seeing it was hopeless. And having found nobody at Bantry either, she steered not for Brest, like most of the others, but for some point south, probably Rochefort. She was commanded by Commodore Lacrosse, a right seaman, and we, Indefatigable and Amazon, 36,
First saw her in thick weather about 3:30 in the afternoon of January the 13th, when we were in 47 degrees 30 minutes north, Ushant bearing northeast 50 leagues, a strengthening squally wind from the westward, and a heavy swell. She was some way to the northeast of us, and far from distinct, but presently we made out that she was a two-decker with no poop, her lower deck gun ports closed, obviously Les Doigts de l'Homme, known for swimming low in the water. And while everyone on the quarterdeck had her in their glasses, a squall hit her, carrying her main topsail braces and then her fore and main topmasts, which fell over her lee guns. They cleared away very quick, expecting us to attack on that side, but when we were within hail and under close-reefed topsails, Sir Edward hauled up the raker. Yet she hauled up too, and we exchanged broadsides. Prodigious musketry on her part from all the soldiers aboard. Then Sir Edward tried to cross her bows and rake her fore and aft. She foiled him again, and did all she could to run us aboard. In avoiding her, we showed our stern. But with her lower deck gun port so near the surface, and the very heavy roll of the ship with so little to steady her, courses and mizzen topsail was all she could spread, she did no great damage. Presently, when it was near full dark, Amazon came pelting up, fired her larboard broadside into the Doigts quarters at pistol shot, and then steered to cross her stern and give her the other. Again, the Doigts clapped her helm over, which brought us both on her less damaged leeward side, and we all blazed away until 7:30, still running southeast, the wind having backed a point or two. Then we and the Amazon shot ahead to knot and splice and fill more powder. We had the legs there, of course, with our topmast standing. An hour later, we were at it again, lying on our bows, one each side and yawing to rake her by turns. Well, she did much the same. She still steered very quick, giving us some hard knocks and trying to board. About 10:30, she cut away her wounded mizzen, and rather later we hauled off to secure our masts, their rigging being much shattered. But apart from that, the fire barely slackened until something after 4 in the morning, when the moon, breaking through the clouds, showed land close on board, and all three ships hauled as near to the wind as ever they could to avoid it. Yet just before dawn, there were breakers white on the lee bow. We warship heading northwards. And when day broke, there was the land again, very close ahead and on the weather bow, with breakers to leeward. Warship to the southwards in 20 fathom water. And then, just after 7, there we saw her. There she lay, the Doigts de l'Homme, right in with the land, broadside up with the tremendous surf beating clean over her. "Just there," he said, pointing, deeply moved by the strength of his recollections. "Just there, beyond that tall pointed rock. At least 600 dead, they say. I'll not go into the horrors of war," he said with an embarrassed smile, conscious of having talked too much. "Anyhow, Doctor, you know much more about them than I do. The Amazon had gone ashore too, but farther along, farther in, and almost all her people were saved. The wind was right on the land, the tide was making, and there was nothing. Nothing we could do for the Doigts de l'Homme. We had 4 foot of water in the hold. We just managed to claw off, though we showed water terribly at one point, and though our people were so utterly exhausted they could scarcely haul the main sheet aft. We lay off for a while, putting the ship into some sort of order, while the surgeon and his mates looked after our wounded, and the cook got at least something for the hands to eat. And although the sea remained very high, the sky soon cleared over the penmarks of the land inshore. It was that which made me think of the Doigts de l'Homme in the first place. The same very curious greenish light over the reef and land, all along from the Cape itself to Saint-Genolé, do you see? Which I was taken to foretell heavy weather. And we certainly had a cruel time of it for the next week or 10 days. Mr. Harding spoke of a week or 10 days, did he not?
Asked Stephen.
I believe so, said Jack. May I trouble you for the marmalade? Oh, I beg pardon. cried Stephen as the ship gave a furious lee lurch and the jar flew from his hand.
Killick! Killick there, swab in a damp cloth and then another pot of marmalade.
Not again, said Killick. Not again. The same yesterday, the same on Thursday, and that was with the poor bloody milk jug too, all the forenoon watch on my bloody knees. Floor cloth never be itself again.
This in a mutter, in a louder voice from beneath the table,
which there ain't no more orange marmalade neither.
When at last he'd gone away, Jack said, fortunately it was only a common old pot, not that splendid Irish cut glass affair you so kindly gave us.
Yes, he did mention 10 days, but only in a manner of speaking, you know. These blows never go by the calendar. When this present tempest slackens, perhaps we shall have a post. I quite long to hear from Woolcombe, and indeed from London and Ballinasloe. I'd been led to believe that one of the very few advantages of the Brest blockade was that it allowed the sufferers frequent supplies of fresh food and mail. To be sure, it is better in that line than, say, the New Holland station. But only in summer. Your informant, the man who led you into this high state of indignation, must have been thinking of the summer, not the season of equinoctial gales or the even more dreadful turning winter storms. But don't despair. The glass is rising quite evenly, so is the humidity. Tomorrow night or the next, which is the dark of the moon, we may have one of the fogs this bay is so famous for, particularly as the wind is sure to fall. Indeed, it is less already.
Steady rain like this often deadens both wind and sea.
When you've finished breakfast, will you not put on a Magellan jacket and take a turn on deck?
I will not. In the first place, because I dislike getting wet, and in the second, because I must complete my account of our sick berth, which Dr. Rutherford wished to recommend for universal adoption. And, of course, there are my medical notes.
Yes, indeed. When you reach any height at all, you spend more time scratching paper than anything else. Well, I've done with the reefers, Mr. Edwards, and I must attend to the fair writing of the log. And I have a score of returns to look over and sign. But after dinner, if it calms enough for you to sit to your cello, let's work our way through the new Bender piece. By all means, is there any more coffee in that pot?
There was.
And having poured it, Stephen said,
I was talking to that boy Gagan, and I find that I know some of his relations in the Spanish service. His grandmother was a Fitzgerald. Will I tell you why he finds it so difficult to coil down a rope in a way that pleases his mentors? Is it not just natural inborn vice?
It is not.
Like many of his nation, he is a Chotog, a left-handed man. And left to himself, he will always coil a rope against the way of the sun. Then clearly he cannot be left to himself.
Jack prosed on about the need for exact uniformity in the service, for all ropes to run smooth, on the dreadful results in an emergency of the contrary practice. And when he paused for a piece of toast, Stephen said,
And there are degrees of left-handedness, some quite insuperable, others to be corrected, if that's the right term, though usually at a cost, sometimes very great to the soul. The harp of Brian of the Tributes, High King of Ireland and an unpersuadable man, carries the melody in the left hand. And this boy's oboe, made by his father, a skilful gentleman from a length of bog oak, is the mirror image of the usual instrument. Would it be improper, do you think, to ask him to play with us? He blows the purest note. Indeed, I love an oboe. It has nothing of the clarinet's cloying sweetness. But as for your boy, he seems a modest, well-bred young fellow, to be sure. Yet I knew a reefer in the West Indies who was amazingly good at chess, could beat anyone. The Admiral, a pretty good player, invited him and was beat time and again. He laughed, but it didn't end happy. The boy got above himself, talked too much, gave himself airs, made himself so unpopular in the cockpit, and was kicked so very often that he had to be transferred. But I'll take particular note of young Gagan at 9 o'clock, and if it can properly be done, we might try. At 9 o'clock, the Bellona's young gentlemen who were not on duty attended in the captain's forecabin, washed, pink, brushed smooth and properly dressed, together with Mr. Walkinshaw, the schoolmaster. "Good morning, sir," they cried, leaping up at the captain's entrance. "Good morning, sir," some gruff, some still shrill, some wavering horribly a full octave. Jack desired them to sit down. Ordinarily, each, by order of seniority, would have shown up his workings. That's to say, his estimate of the ship's position, determined by observation of the sun's height at noon, or by double altitudes, by dead reckoning, and on occasion by a certain amount of copying from their more gifted messmates. But the weather of the last days had been such that no observation was possible, and Jack only required Mr. Walkinshaw to lead them through Pythagoras once again, calling upon each in turn to rehearse the theorems upon which this most elegant, satisfying, and wholly convincing argument was based. In his youth, Jack had been wretchedly taught, mere rule of thumb at the best, and it was only quite late that the beauty of Pythagoras and Napier's bones had been revealed to him, lighting a love of the mathematics that had burned steadily ever since. And he hoped that repeated exposure to them both might do the same for his youngsters. Generally speaking, it had answered for one or two boys in each commission, which would probably not have happened if he'd relied on ship schoolmasters. The man he had at present, Mr. Walkinshaw, was better than most. He knew a fair amount about mathematics and navigation, and he was generally sober. But like most of his kind, he had very little authority. He messed with the midshipmen in the cockpit. He was little better paid than they. The regulations gave him no status in the ship, and he would have had to be an exceptional man to acquire one by force of character. Mr. Walkinshaw hadn't managed to do so, and his lessons were far quieter, more orderly and useful when the Almighty was present, listening most of the time, interposing on occasion, learning a great deal about the boys. Today, his eyes rested more often on Gagan than the others. Again, he noticed his awkward, cramped, left-handed manner of writing, his modest way of answering a question, his smile when he was told that the answer was right. A smile that would have been enchanting if he'd been a girl. "He's too pretty for his own good. Too pretty by far," Jack reflected. "He'd be an odious little beast, was he aware of it. Fortunately, he ain't." "Mr. Dormer," he said to a young gentleman whose attention seemed to be wandering, "pray define a logarithm." Dormer blushed, straightened himself, and said, "A logarithm, sir, is when you raise 10 to the power that gives the number you first thought of." After a few more answers of this kind, Jack desired Mr. Walkinshaw to return to his remarks on the principles of spherical trigonometry and leafed through the rough copy of the Bellona's logbook that his clerk was to write fair later in the day, when the diminished sea might make fair writing more nearly possible. "Never say that I'm no weather prophet," said Jack, as he and Stephen sat down to dinner at a table that no longer required fiddles to keep the plates from one's lap. "And I believe my fog is on its way." "God love you for your words, my dear. I should have been sorely vexed to miss my rendezvous. Yet it mustn't be too thick, for although our Brittany pilot knows the bay like his own bed, he has to have a terminus a quo and a terminus ad quem." He gave Stephen a satisfied look and paused. But Stephen's face, civilly attentive, showed no change whatsoever. And Jack, never one to bear resentment, went on, "He's marking Ramillies's chart at present. By the way, I asked Ramillies to dinner today. We have an enormous great fat goose, but he begged to be excused. He's taking medicine." This meant that at 7 bells in the morning watch, the Ramillies's captain had stuffed himself with rhubarb, brimstone, the inspissated juice of figs, and any other cathartics that happened to be at hand, so that he would be confined to the seat of ease in his quarter gallery, groaning and straining for the greater part of the day, clearly unfit as a guest at a dinner table. I wonder that a man of Captain Fanshawe's intelligence, education, and taste should persist in that deleterious, superstitious self-torment,"
said Stephen in a tone of real indignation.
"It is one of the unhappiest legacies of dark ages, of mere barbarity."
"Oh," said Jack, "but William Fanshawe studied health, you know. And he understands more about it than most, I do assure you. He's a great reader. And he has a book by a man called Pigott, who was all for the superiority of vegetables over bread, and who maintained that caps were far, far better for you than hats. His arguments, as I recall, were wonderfully convincing, to do with the humours." This was not the first time that Stephen had learned about medicine from sea officers. As usual, he merely bowed, and at much the same moment, the enormous great fat goose came in, Killick bearing it against the swell with a very fixed expression indeed on his face, and setting it down without a drop of the abundant grease astray. When the massive remains of the bird, expertly carved by Stephen, had been sent down to the midshipman's berth according to the humane naval custom, and when the port was going to and fro, Jack said, "I considered your young fellow this morning, and I think we might try. In these cases, there's always the danger that if it don't answer, it may do the boy or young man harm. I have known cases. Yet I think here we might try. Do you know the Mozart oboe quartet in F major?"
"Yes, sir."
"Of course you do, of course you do," cried Jack. "I was only calling it to mind. No, what I mean is that I should love to hear it again. And Paisley's a respectable hand with a viola. We played it in Funchal with those cheerful Portuguese friars. And again, where? I forget. But I do remember that the viola broke a string in its most important passage and we were all thrown into a sad confusion, a sudden loss of all cohesion, the ground dropping from beneath one's feet. Anticlimax is far too weak an expression. Naples. It was off Naples. The oboe was a castrato from the opera and John Hill of the Leviathan played the viola, at least as far as we went. I remember the grief of it. No spare strings. Stephen, may I beg you to ask Paisley whether he'd like to study the score? Coming from me, it would be so very like an order, and he is, after all, your messmate. And do you think you could find out whether the boy would be capable of bearing his part, whether he'd like to try? And if so, whether he, too, would choose to have the score? Don't take it amiss, Stephen, but these things would come so much better from a man who can clap leeches to their temples, or rouse out their liver and lights, for their own good, of course, than from a fellow who cannot be contradicted and whose prime function is to command. Now, I put it very badly, I find. Don't be offended, Stephen. I don't really believe in all this gold lace. I don't really esteem myself another pompous pilot or Alexander the Great.
Never in life, my dear. As for young Gagin, I understand that chamber music has been part of his family life since he was a little boy. And as for the purser, I know that he plays in his parish choir when he's ashore, and that although in the wardroom it's mostly Vauxhall and Ranelagh airs, he's perfectly capable of other things. Now, pouring each another glass of wine, pray tell me about this Brittany pilot.
Oh, he's one of the fishermen Calliope picked up when she was rescuing people who were trying to escape after the Vendée fighting. Royalists, of course.
Just so. I presume they've been carefully sieved.
Oh, I'm sure of it. They've been with us, scattered about the fleet ever since. And I believe that during the peace they brought their families across to Market Jew in Cornwall. They have the same kind of language, as I'm sure you know, and they get along famously with the country people and fishermen. This one is called Jan. The Admiral sent him over some little time ago to mark all our charts. He's marking Ramillies now, and he should be with us tomorrow.
So much the better.
Stephen finished his glass and said, I shall make my rounds now, and if the sea grows even a little more reasonable, I believe we may have some music after supper.
And if the rounds don't take long, I shall have made my inquiries well before that. Well, my dear,
he said, coming in just before their toasted cheese, an invariable supper dish whenever they were within reach of the prime essentials. That was eminently satisfactory. I found the boy by mere chance, and he puzzling over a knot with his sea daddy. Are you acquainted with the expression? Fairly well. My own sea daddy, dear old William Parsons, was the best of men, endlessly patient. So was this one. Again and again he said, "No, sir." Right over left and then up through the bight without any wounding emphasis. And when at last the knot was tied, he said that Nelson couldn't have done it better. That Mr. Gagan would make a seaman yet. He then walked off to stow the rope wherever ropes are stowed, and I talked to the boy. Of course he knew the quartet, had played it repeatedly at home, his father with the cello, his uncle Kevin the fiddle, and cousin Patrick the viola. But should be very happy to look over the score again. Mr. Paisley was almost as good. He didn't absolutely assert that he'd borne a part of this particular quartet, but he let it be understood that he was intimately familiar with it, and even if he hadn't been, he was, as the skipper himself would testify, so practised a sight reader that he didn't need to study the score before sitting down to it, so long as he had a good light on his music stand. Certainly I have known him make his way through a sheaf of handwritten sheets seen for the very first time in a very creditable manner. What joy! Allow me to help you to some of this capital-smelling cheese, if you would be so good. What you tell me of tomorrow's weather? Is it likely to be suitable? I will swear to nothing. But Harding and the master, who both know Ushant well, are of the same opinion. Unless it grows so thick that we cannot see our music, why then tomorrow, touching wood, should be all that a reasonable being could ask. And indeed, the four reasonable beings could hardly have been better served. There was still a heavy swell from the southwest, and urged on by the making tide, it broke high, white and dreadful, on the islands and reefs of the Saints and the mainland cliffs. But the wind had dropped to no more than a topgallant breeze, and although Jack's fog had made its infant appearance in the form of a veiling mist, there was no question of its blurring even a hemi-demi-semi-quaver. Yet when Jack and Stephen met for breakfast, each looked at the other with a considering eye, and Stephen said, "Melancholy, brother?" "Hipped." "Somewhat," said Jack. "I don't much like the behaviour of the glass," pointing to an elegant barometer in brass gimbals. "Nor do I much care for poverty. I cannot afford to keep a table for my officers. I cannot afford to entertain my fellow captains in the traditional service fashion. And what is more, I cannot afford to buy extra powder to eke out our miserable allowance. Today, to the astonishment of one and all, we shall beat to quarters and carry out the great gun exercise. But your only worthwhile exercise is with the true discharge, the furious recoil, the cloud of smoke. And even on this perfect day, we can afford only two real broadsides for each battery. But, Stephen, you're in much the same case, I believe. Haunted by the Blue Devils? Glum? That's nothing that coffee and perhaps a very lightly boiled egg will not bear away," said Stephen. "Yet I am saddened by the reflection that although age has not yet seriously decayed my powers in other directions, or so I flatter myself, I have real difficulty in grasping the geography of this behemoth of a vessel. The sick bay I know perfectly well, the wardroom, and this series of booths and cabins, but when I walk about at haphazard, as I was doing when I chanced upon young Gagan, I grow strangely bemused, scarcely knowing front from back, whereas in the dear surprise, bless her by all means, I knew every recess, however remote, and of course all the people. Here I'm something of a stranger in a largely unknown city. I don't find my not inconsiderable maritime knowledge increases, and I am by no means sure that the bold figure of speech I heard directed by an aged quartermaster at a ship's buoy, 'Thou wilt never shit a seaman's turd,' may not be applied to me.
"Never in life," cried Jack. "You're the most seaman-like ship's surgeon I've ever known. Never in life. Killick! Killick, dear! Light a lung that goddamn coffee, for heaven's sake!"
"Which," began Killick. But seeing the captain's face, he closed his mouth and the door.
"Not at all, Stephen. You ought to consider you've not been aboard very long. And for most of the last commission, you were either looking after the sick or travelling about the African wilderness collecting rarities, except when you were sick yourself, very sick, very nearly dead, or so weak as to be able to do no more than creep about the poop."
"Killick! Which it's coming, ain't it?"
cried Killick from behind his loaded tray, "with a 2 minute this morning's egg for his honour."
Breakfast did indeed sweep away a good deal of superficial melancholy. And after it, they walked up the poop, watching the sun rise round and orange over France. What mist there was, and it was thickening, didn't yet hide all the ships of the inshore squadron, and Jack pointed them out in the stations where Fanshawe, his senior by 6 months and therefore in command, had placed them.
"There's Ramillies, right in the middle of the Iroese Passage," he said, nodding towards a rosy haze of topsails almost due north. "And if you were to jump up to the masthead and clear the haze away, you'd see one of the frigates, probably Phoebe, guarding the way out of the Passage du Four. A good many vessels try to get into Brest from the north that way. And between the frigate and Ramillies, you can make out a cutter even now, Fox, I believe, lying there to pass on signals." He ran through the meagre tale of ships posted off most of the important means of access, just as the Bellona was posted within gunshot of the Ras de Seine. And among other things, he showed him the general position of the uncharted or badly charted rock upon which HMS Magnificent struck in the year 4, on Lady Day in the year 4. A total loss. But her people were all saved by the boats of the squadron, mostly from the Impetia, as I recall. "Mr. Harding," he said to his hovering first lieutenant, "I believe you wish to speak to me." "Yes, sir," said Harding, stepping forward and taking off his hat. "I beg pardon for interrupting you, sir, but the Nimble is finding it hard to stem the tide, and if we want any effect of surprise among the people, perhaps we might call for the targets right away."
"Make it so, Mr. Harding, make it so."
And to Stephen, "How I ramble on." He rambled no longer. The Nimble had been anxiously watching the Bellona's upper rigging, and as soon as the signals broke out, her boat shoved off, towing their targets. "We'll beat to quarters, Mr. Harding, if you please," said Jack, and almost instantly the drum volleyed and thundered. Some few of the newer, heavier Bellonas hadn't caught the signs of the coming exercise. The gunner's very particular attention to his charges, the captains of the gun crew's sly checking of tackles, tackle falls, trucks, ladles, rammers, sponges, worms, and their absent-minded easing of the tompions. And those few were properly amazed by the din. But by now all, except the very, very stupid landsmen, at least knew their action stations, and they ran to them, while the very few exceptions were kindly guided by the boatswain's mates. Dr. Matcher in the station was, of course, the after cockpit. And here he stood with his assistants, William Smith and Alexander Macaulay, together with a few unsatisfactory makeshift loblolly boys, farrier's apprentices or out-of-work slaughterhouse hands. And in this space, bare except for instrument racks and the chests of the midshipmen, its usual inhabitants, heaved together and lashed to form an operating table, they stood silently listening. The three foremost upper-deck starboard 18-pounders bore on the leading target almost at the same moment and fired with a triple crash that made the hanging lanterns tremble. They were instantly followed by the huge, much deeper voices of the gun-deck 32-pounders. And for the next 5 minutes the entire hull was filled with a great bellowing din, so confused that no separate discharge other than those directly overhead could be distinguished. At the same time, powder smoke came below, wafting its heady smell about them. Then, all at once, a deafened silence, followed by the rumble of guns being housed.
"Sir," cried William Smith, much too loud, "I saw a very curious thing.
Whenever there was a split second between the explosions just over us, each produced a different tremor in the smoke. You could distinctly see it against the lit edge of the lantern. He spoke with something of the excitement of battle, and with much the same freedom, Macaulay said that he did hope it had been a satisfactory exercise. There was such an agreeable feeling in the ship when they'd done well. Before Stephen could reply, the first of the casualties came down the after hatch carried by his teammates. A young marine who'd been stationed in one of the after 32-pounders to help run her up, she weighed about 3 tons, and who had misjudged the speed and force of the recoil.
"A very moderate tourniquet for 20 minutes, Mr. Macaulay, if you please," said Stephen, sewing up the gash, "and a spiker bandage, but by no means tight."
Macaulay had been dresser to a famous London surgeon, and his bandages were marvels of regularity, the admiration of all the seamen. But regularity was often cousin to constraint, itself close kin to gangrene. In the early days of a commission, when many of the pressed men were still sad lobcocks without discernment or sea legs, it was usual for these exercises to cause a fair amount of damage. So much so that when Stephen returned to the quarterdeck, Jack asked, "What was the butcher's bill this time?"
"A few sprains and rope burns," said Stephen, "and one flesh wound. A strip of gastrocnemius, more spectacular than grave. As I sewed it up, I reflected upon gangrene, always a possibility, and upon an interesting treatment that I discussed aboard the flag." Yet as he spoke, he remembered his friend's odd squeamishness about some aspects of medicine, and even more of surgery, and broke off to exclaim at the smoke bank from their exercise, still remarkably solid and coherent, there away to leeward. "A satisfactory exercise, I trust?"
"Tolerably, sir, I thank you, for what very little it amounts to. Scarcely more than 2 full broadsides. Still, with so many well-trained crews, it was reasonably accurate and pretty brisk, roughly the equivalent of 2.5 minutes. And after all, the Royal George sank the Superb in Quiberon Bay with only 2 broadsides. Very heavy weather indeed, and not one of her 600 people saved." They fell silent, both thinking of an earlier command, the Leopard, which sank a Dutch man of war in the high southern latitudes, also with the loss of all hands. One or two messengers reached the captain, who dealt with them in a firm, competent, official voice. Then, turning to Stephen, he said in an undertone, "I'm so looking forward to our concert tomorrow." So is Stephen. But he was concerned for the prime performer, the oboe, the essence of their meeting. From the dispensary, far aft on the orlop deck, where he and William Smith spent some of the next forenoon grinding quicksilver, hog's lard and mutton suet together to make blue ointment, he could hear Gagan practising in the nearby midshipman's berth, playing scales, changing his reeds, and venturing upon some of the more remarkable flights open to a well-tempered oboe. The Bellona had a reasonably good-natured set of midshipmen and master's mates, 12 of them, mostly the sons of friends and former shipmates. Certainly the younger members of the berth showed no obvious signs of oppression, and although Gagan was probably the youngest there, just old enough to be admitted to the berth rather than entrusted to the gunner with the youngsters, he clearly never hesitated to play serious, difficult music there. This was the more curious because of his somewhat anomalous position. He'd been born on the books of several ships commanded by his father's friends or relatives in order to gain nominal sea time without actually going afloat. A fairly common practice, but one that brought the young gentlemen aboard with so little knowledge of their profession that they were something of a burden to their shipmates. Often unpopular, sometimes cruelly treated, but... Yet this was not the case with Gagan.
"Of course, he's a very good-looking boy," observed Stephen. "Perhaps that has something to do with it. One has an innate, wholly disinterested kindness for beauty."
The ointment was now made, and Smith carried off a suitable number of gallipots for their syphilitic patients. Stephen shut and double-locked the dispensary door,
seamen were much given to dosing themselves, and hearing the main body of reefers leave their berth with a sound like that of a herd of mad cattle, he walked in. "Good day, sir," said Gagan, leaping up.
"And a very good day to you, Mr. Gagan," said Stephen. "Please, may I see your instrument again?" It was a beautiful oboe, formed from the most elegant dark, dark wood. But neither praise of its appearance nor of its lovely tone seemed to give much pleasure, and Stephen returned to their earlier talk of Bantry Bay, the country round it, including the Reverend Mr. Gagan's parish, and their common acquaintances. The boy was perfectly polite, perfectly well-bred, but it was clear that he didn't wish for any close contact at this moment, nor any comfort for his evident anxiety. In the civilest way, he was saying that he was not to be manipulated, nor to be made to be easy in his mind when he was not easy in his mind, however kind the intention. "He's a respectable boy," said Stephen, walking off. "But I could wish he were not quite so tense. Were it not for some illogical and even perhaps superstitious reluctance, respect for innocence, I should prescribe 15 or even 20 drops of laudanum." Laudanum, the alcoholic tincture of opium, a delightful tawny liquid that had floated Dr. Maturin through many a bout of the most extreme anxiety and distress, though at a moral and spiritual cost that eventually became exorbitant. It was now replaced by moderate use of the Peruvian coca leaf. The boy was tenser still when he appeared at the door of the captain's cabin, carrying his oboe in a green baize bag, as the last stroke of 5 bells in the afternoon watch was struck. The berth had done him proud. Not only was he as popular as a boy who as no seaman could very well be, but his appearance would reflect upon the credit of the after cockpit as a whole, including Callahan and 3 other master's mates, and that almost godlike figure, William Reed, who had so often sailed with the captain before, losing an arm in battle in the East Indies. And now his hair, having been strongly brushed, was tied so tight behind that it stretched his features into a look of astonishment, while his face shone pink from an almost entirely superfluous shave. The brass buttons on his best blue coat outshone even those on his captain's uniform, while the white patches on his collar, called by some quarterly accounts and by others the mark of Cain, would have put virgin snow to shame. "There you are, Mr. Gagan," cried Jack. "I'm very happy to see you. Come and have a glass of sherry." After the sherry, they sat down to a dish of codlings caught over the side that morning, to a pair of roast fowls with bacon and a great many sausages, to a noble apple pie, and to the best part of a cheddar cheese. The midshipman's berth usually dined at noon, and Gagan, after a hesitant beginning, laid into his food with a wolfish concentration, replying, "If you please, sir," to any suggestion of more. "The young gent has ate 11 potatoes," said Killick to his mate, passing the empty dish. "Go and see if the wardroom left any." At last, when the cloth had been drawn and the king's health drunk in a glass of port suited to a very young head, they took their coffee and ratafia biscuits, the sea-going equivalent of petit four, in the great cabin, where the cello, the viola, and the fiddle leaned by their respective music-stands, well lit by the great stern window, a suffused grey near brilliance, with the ship standing west-sou-west under reef topsails, making little more than steerage way on a gently rolling sea. "Another cup, Mr. Paisley?" asked Jack. "Mr. Gagan?" "Then, in that case, perhaps we should set to." They spread their scores, and as they did so, Stephen remembered with some concern that in the F major quartet, the opening notes were played by the oboe alone. But when, after the necessary squeaking and grunting as the stringed instruments tuned themselves, Jack smiled at Gagan and nodded,
These same crucial notes came out clear and pure with no overemphasis. A beautiful round tone in which the strings joined almost at once. And almost at once, they were a quartet, playing happily along with as nearly perfect an understanding as was possible on so short an acquaintance. With scarcely a pause, they swam through the elegant melancholy of the adagio, Jack Aubrey particularly distinguishing himself, and Stephen booming nobly. But it was in the rondo that the oboe came wholly into its own, singing away with an exquisite gay delicacy infinitely enjoyed by all four. And to all four, in spite of the music before them, it seemed to last for an indefinite space before coming to the perfect simplicity of its end.
"Well done! Well done indeed!" cried Jack, leaning forward and shaking Gagin's hand. "What a glorious pipe you blow, upon my word and honour. I've really enjoyed music more, if ever, indeed."
Gagin blushed extremely. But before he could answer, there was an imperative knock at the door, and Mr. Edwards, the captain's clerk, came in with an untidy, disparate sheaf of papers in his hand. "Sir," he said, "here are the memorandums we were to send to the flag, just your rough notes. You said you'd read them for me to copy fair. The boat's here has been this half-glass, and he's growing outrageous."
"By God," cried Jack, "it clean slipped my mind. Gentlemen, forgive me, I beg, but had we gone on, we couldn't possibly have done better. I thank you all very heartily indeed."
They filed out, with proper acknowledgements and in due order of rank. Gagin, standing back to let Stephen pass, looked at him with open affection, all constraint and tension gone. And with Edward settled at a desk, Jack began from his informal and often cryptic notes. "Purser, provisions for 9 weeks full of all species except wine, of that only 39 days. Master, 113 tons of water, beef very good. Pork sometimes shrinks in the boiling, the rest of the provisions very good. In cutting up provisions, master's mate, bosun's mate, captain forecastle, captain tops and quartermaster. Pretty well supplied with stores, rigging and sails in good order. 2 pair of main shrouds cut in the eyes. Gunner, 18 rounds of powder filled, plenty of wads, 40 rounds. Carpenter, hull in good state. Knee of the head supported by 2 cheeks. Masts and yards in good state. Pretty well stored."
That was a very glorious piece. "The glorious piece of the world, indeed," said Stephen,
as he and Gagin separated outside the wardroom. The purser had already gone forward.
"So it was, too," said Gagin, "and how I admired the captain's double stopping. Yours, too, sir. But I'm glad it didn't go on. It was perfect like that. And I was afraid that if we started again it might take a great while and I should miss the last dog."
"A particularly amiable creature, I make no doubt."
"Oh, sir,"
said Gagin with that delicate kindness the young sometimes reserve for the old, ignorant and stupid.
"I should have said watch. The last dog watch. The second of those short ones at the end of the day, you know. When we're going along under a very moderate sail and there's nothing much to do, no possibility of all hands being called, we reefers, whose watch isn't on deck, often play about aloft. We call it skylarking."
"I've heard of it."
"Indeed, I've not infrequently seen the phenomenon. Yet it's not invariably confined to the young and light built. Captain Aubrey and Admiral Mitchell once raced to the topmost point of a vessel whose name escapes me for a dozen of champagne."
"Heavens, sir, pray who won?"
"Oh, faith, the Admiral said he did. And who's to contradict an Admiral, a senior? Superiores, priores, you know."
"Yes, indeed, sir. But if you'll excuse me now, sir, I must go below and store my pipe and change my clothes. Old Dormer and I are to see which can touch the main t'gallant truck first."
Gagan ran down the ladder, and in the lightness of his heart he kicked both his best silver-buckled shoes far into the cockpit. Callahan was the only other person in the berth. He was writing a letter by the light of a purser's dip, writing with close concentration to his young woman. But he looked up and asked how dinner in the cabin had gone. "Oh, very well indeed, once I got started. Codlings, of course, and then a pair of huge, enormous, great, prodigious fowls. Capons, I think. And the doctor kept carving me glorious great bits and passing sausages. I couldn't in decency say no. And then there was an apple pie the bigness of a moderate wheel, and cheese, of course."
"What did you drink?"
"Sherry, wine, claret, and then port."
During his discourse, Gagan had taken off and folded away all his good clothes, and now he was in a striped Guernsey shirt and old sailcloth trousers.
"Well, I hope you didn't eat too much. You must take it easy at first.
Many a reefer have I known throw up his dinner merely from topping at the Nimble Ape among the royals and t'gallants too soon after a meal."
The ships that blockaded Brest off Ushant or nearer inshore in the bay itself were so very often blown and battered by strong sou'westers, often bringing rain, or by north and north-east winds, which might allow the enemy to come out, therefore calling for the closest attention, that the ship's boys and young gentlemen, to say nothing of the more athletic officers, had little chance of skylarking. And when it came, they made the most of it. Stephen Maturin, though very much a spectator aboard, and very much given to standing on the poop or quarterdeck of a healthy ship, in a sickly one he spent most of his time below, and there watching the various manoeuvres, or, in times of relative idleness, the dancing on the forecastle and the skylarking, had rarely seen so numerous a gathering. Right forward there was a fiddler and a man with a tabor playing hornpipes for a close-packed group on the forecastle, where the more expert dancers carried out some very elaborate steps indeed, to the delight of their friends, who clapped hands in time. But what caught his eye more immediately was the number of boys. The Bellona carried 50 or more, officers' servants, apprentices to the gunner, boatswain, carpenter, or the like, and plain ship's boys. And nearly all of them were gathered either along the larboard gangway leading from the quarterdeck to the forecastle, or were already aloft, tearing about among the rigging and sometimes making great swings from one part to another like gibbons, high, high above the deck. Some were racing, some were merely having fun, moving with wonderful ease and certainty. The midshipmen, on the other hand, using the term in its widest sense, from master's mate right down to first-class volunteer, the young gentlemen as a whole, kept to the starboard side, either on the quarter-deck itself, which was their right, or along the starboard gangway. And they too were spending much of their time high in the air, apparently weightless, except when they slid with enormous speed down a stay, landing with a thump. While Stephen stood there, a fat midshipman called Dormer, the boy that Gagan was to race, came down the main-to-gallant backstay into the main chains with such force that his knees buckled under him. Stephen helped him over the hammock netting onto the deck and asked whether the friction didn't scorch his hands. "Not much, sir," he replied with a pleasant confidence, "because now I'm a really hardened old salt and I check the rush with my feet." He showed his palms, and although they were much stained with tar, there was no trace of a burn. "Now, sir," he said, "I'm going to make the great traverse."
"I shall watch you with close attention," said Stephen.
And he certainly meant to do so. But there were such numbers of boys and young men, the Bellona had about 600 people aboard, moving in every direction, up, down, sideways and diagonally, often very fast, that he soon lost sight of Dormer. All the sooner since an ambiguous turn came over, together with two gannets. Having fixed the turn, an immature sandwich in a sad state of molt, he returned to his contemplation of the skylarkers, and after a while his earlier impression was confirmed. Although the ship's boys kept to the larboard and the young gentlemen to the starboard, And although there was virtually no direct communication between them, there was, nevertheless, a tacit rivalry. Some uncommonly agile boy, often the boatswain's servant, would perform an exceptional and exceedingly dangerous feat. And with nothing but looks of intelligence between the more expert reefers, their champion would do the same or better. He watched this for some time, and quite suddenly he recognised young Gagan and the striped Guernsey-shirted boy who was obviously doing his utmost to outpace Dormer on his way up the main topmast rigging. He was clearly less experienced than Dormer, but Dormer had already taken a great deal of exercise. He was fat, and he was tiring fast. They were on opposite sides of the main topmast shrouds, high up where they narrowed to pass through the topgallant crosstrees. Very near the top, where the main topgallant futtock shrouds diverged far from the vertical, Gagan leant backwards, one hand whipping out for the futtock, the other for the forward crosstrees, and here, both holds slipping in his haste, he fell. Fell almost straight, just brushing the main top in his fall, and striking one of the starboard quarterdeck carronades, not a yard from the officer of the watch. Stephen had been walking aft to meet Jack as he came from talking to the master by the wheel. At the general cry, he turned, and calling out, "Don't move him!" he ran to Gagan, hoping that there might not be too much damage, that, taken below with great care, he might be recovered. After a moment's examination, he could only report instant death. Jack picked the boy up and carried him into the great cabin, tears running down his face. Later that evening, they sewed him into his hammock with 32-pound round shot at his feet and buried him over the side according to the custom of the sea. The fog increased that night, and Jack spent most of his time on deck, together with Woodbine and Harding, both of them experienced navigators with a fair knowledge of the waters off Brest. The Bellona had lain to near the Amen Rock for the brief ceremony, and she had now to feel her way across some 20 miles of often dangerous water to a point a little west of St. Matthew's. Most of the places had English names, where either the Ramillies or one of her boats would meet her, bringing the Brittany pilot and Stephen's colleague. For tomorrow was the dark of the moon, the time for the landing in Dogleg Cove. Although the very slowly falling glass foretold dirty weather in the near future, Jack felt reasonably confident that he should be able to carry out his plan, which was to beat steadily up and down between the Black Rocks and the Saints by day, as usual, and at nightfall, after the turn of the tide, to double back and run through the Ras de Seine with the current, dropping Stephen as near to the cove as he dared, and then to stand off and wait for the boat anchored south of the Ile de Seine. 12 fathom water and good holding ground. But first, of course, there was the essential rendezvous. And with the log heaved every glass, or sometimes more often, and the lead going steadily, they sailed west by north with the wind 1.3, the fog streaming across the binnacles and the storm lantern. When, by their very close and concordant reckoning, they were well beyond the Eroese passage, the breeze strengthened, veering northwards. And presently it became obvious that even close hauled they couldn't reach the channel through the islands they'd hoped for. Jack, therefore, wore ship and set a necessary but most disagreeable course that would bring them close to the southern fringe of the Black Rocks and their outliers, not always accurately charted. This held until 4 bells in the middle watch. Low tide. When the infernal breeze wavered, grew uneasy, uttered some violent gusts, and hauled a full point forward with every sign of doing worse. Before it could come frankly into the northeast and head him, Jack Aubrey changed course yet again, and stood right across the mouth of the Passage du Four, which had no more than 7 fathoms in some places. The Bellona drew 6. on and on. The three men, entirely closed upon their continually developing calculations, all based on the frequent reports of the ship's progress, their informed estimate of her leeway under this trim and with this wind, the ebb and flow of the tide, the force of local currents, the occasional dive into the master's sea cabin abaft the wheel, whereby a dim light, a chart as accurate as present knowledge would allow, was spread out, and on their own sense of the sea, intuitive, pragmatical, hardly to be reduced to words. I wonder whether the others hear and feel that wicked grind and crack as we strike a reef, said Jack to himself. Probably. He'd felt it this last glass and more as they drew nearer and nearer to St. Matthew's, now perhaps no more than a few cables' length away in the northeast. Then aloud, Mr. Woodbine, do you smell anything? Pause. No, sir. Captain Aubrey, in a carrying voice. Back the main topsail. Start the sheet right forward there. To the man at the wheel. Down with the helm. The way came off the Bellona. She lay there, heaving in the fog, and a voice, some way on her starboard bow, called, "The ship ahoy! What ship's that?" "Bellona," replied Harding. Relief, coupled with the intensity of Woodbine's unspoken question, moved Jack to say, "It's low tide, of course, and I caught a waft of the rotting kelp." When the Ramillies' boat had set both its passengers aboard, he left orders for the officer of the watch. The course due south was safe for the next few hours. Told Harding and the master to get some sleep, and walked softly into the cabin he was sharing with Stephen. "Is all well?" asked Stephen. "Yes. Your man's aboard, and I've put him in the coach. The bosun's looking after the pilot. I'm afraid I woke you." "Not at all, at all. Will you not turn in?" "Scarcely seems worth it. But perhaps I shall." For once, his deep-founded habit of going to sleep at once abandoned him. He lay awake for two bells and the first strokes of a third, working out the letters he was to send to Gagan's parents. As a captain, he'd had to do this several times. It was never easy, but this time the words would scarcely come at all. The cleaning of the deck before sunrise no longer woke Stephen, but the piping up of hammocks and the sound of bare feet just overhead did so quite abruptly. He stared about, collecting himself, and without surprise he saw Jack come in, pink and obviously new-shaven, even in this dim light. "Good morning to you, my dear," he said. "What of the day?" "Good morning, Stephen. I trust you slept. It's cleared a little, but you still cannot see 100 yards, and we've barely more than steerage way. Do you choose to trim yourself? The sea's smooth, and I can put a famous edge on your razor if you'd like it, and there's your guest. He will breakfast with us, no doubt." "Oh," said Stephen, passing a hand over his jaw, "I'll do admirably for a day or two, until Sunday, indeed. In any case, I know Mr. Bernard well." Mr. Bernard, Inigo Bernard, came from Barcelona, where his family, considerable shipbuilders and shipowners, had been engaged in trade with English merchants for some generations. He'd been educated in England, and he spoke the language perfectly. Yet, like his family, he remained deeply Catalan. Catalan to the extent of bitterly resenting the Spanish oppression of his country, and of supporting the clandestine movement for autonomy, if not downright independence. And it was this that had first brought him and Stephen Maturin together. Yet in much the same way as Stephen, he had early decided that the French invasion, most particularly atrocious in Catalonia, required him to ally himself with any of the forces that opposed the enemy. In his case, with the Spanish government. He had been more fortunate, though by no means less enterprising than Maturin, as an active member of his secret movement, and his name was to be found on no official lists of rebels or subversive elements. He was therefore able to join one of the Spanish intelligence services particularly concerned with naval matters. And when the Spaniards changed sides on the unfortunate advice of the Prince of Peace and became subservient to Buonaparte, he was very well placed for passing information, above all naval information, to his friend. Even now that Spain was wholeheartedly at war with France once more, their collaboration had its advantages. And the two of them were now engaged on a joint mission, for the French side was by no means a united whole, but contained many people with divided loyalties, to say nothing of double agents. He presented himself for breakfast in the great cabin as trim and properly dressed as his host, which made a good impression, and the meal passed off well, though in a rather formal manner. Jack, in these circumstances, was perfectly discreet, and Bernard was far from expansive, confining himself to generalities and well-received observations about the beauty of the ship, and above all of the truly splendid cabin. After this, Jack left them alone, except for dinner, spending much of his time with Harding, and even more with the boatswain, reinforcing the ship against the expected blow, though he reserved some hours for Jan, marking the Bellona's charts according to his expert advice, and listening to what he had to say about these waters. "Soon, perhaps the day after Wednesday," said Jan. He had difficulty with Thursday, though on the whole he was quite fluent. "It will settle in the southwest and blow horrid, but I don't have to tell you about preventer staysail," he added, looking with pleasure at the Bellona's rigging. And after a pause he said, "I wonder them buggers," nodding towards Brest, "didn't try for it when the wind was in the northeast. It was true northeast for a pair of hours after you picked us up. Plenty of time for a frigate to have come down the Goulet and away by the Iruise, ni vous ni connu. Or a fast ship of the line, for that matter, like their Romulus." "Tell me, Jan," said Jack, "if it stays as thick as this, will you undertake to carry the ship through the Raz? With no moonlight at all?" "As thick as this, sir? I should be happier in a frigate or a sloop than in a heavy great 74 as thick as this. I could do it, because the ebbing tide dashes up so white on the Vieille that I could barely miss it, knowing where to look since I was a boy." He held his hand flattened low down to show his height when first he saw the Vieille. "But never make yourself bad blood, sir. It will not stay as thick as this." How true! Towards sunset, when they were lying off the Menglar waiting for the tide, the wind settled in the nor'east again, and although there were patches of true fog still in the east and nor'east over the land, most of the bay to larboard was no more than misty. Indeed, some fishing boats could dimly be seen on the larboard beam half a mile away. Larboard because, at this point, Jack was some way along his northward run, the ordinary routine patrol. When darkness was almost complete, he desired Harding to summon the officer of the watch, Hewell in this case, the master's mates and midshipmen. And when they were all there on the quarter-deck, he said, "Gentlemen, in 15 minutes I shall put the ship about. I should like this manoeuvre to be executed as silently as possible and with almost nothing in the way of light. And we shall proceed under reefed courses alone. There's no mad hurry. We're not running a race. But let there be no singing out. Each officer must pick his men. This is no caper for raw hands, however stout and willing. Mr. Reed, you've checked the blue cutter, I believe?"
"Yes, sir," said Reed, smiling in the dark. "And I believe all is as you could wish."
Against strong opposition from the more conservative and from his own heart, Jack had rigged davits above the Bellona's quarter-galleries, taking away somewhat from her beauty and committing an innovation. But now he rejoiced in the thought of that boat hanging there, fully equipped, ready to be stepped into by the less expert, and lowered down without danger
without anxiety on either part. He'd put Stephen ashore in many and many a place, generally by night. And the anguish, even in a dead calm sea, of watching his unsteady, lurching journey down the side, though helped by gravity and devoted hands, had added years to his apparent age. Any innovation, however barbarous, was worth the relief of seeing him sitting there with his hands folded, his baggage beside him, and the whole container and contents very gently descending until it touched the surface, with Bondon there to fend off, and the cutter's crew leaping down like cats. All this, however, in the future. Once the ship had been put about, which was done with creditable speed in near silence, and once she was heading south by east under reefed courses with the wind a little abaft the beam, as inconspicuous as a ship of the line could ever hope to be, her captain's station was in the foretop with the pilot, an attentive midshipman on deck to relay his orders. For a long while there were no orders to relay. Jack and the pilot discussed the clearing of the mist, likely to be complete by the morning, the Bellona's leeway very slight, and her present position. On the starboard bow, sir, you can just make out the bar then. The course half a point to larboard, sir, if you please. Thus, very well thus. And was it day you would see Dead Men's Bay to leeward? A long silence, in which they heard the muted strokes of five bells in the first watch. Now, sir, said Jan, we are well into the royals, the tide running 3 knots and more, and in 10 minutes on the larboard bow, if God wishes, you will see the white water on the Vieille. This westerly breeze across the strong ebb should throw it quite high. Jack stared hard over the larboard bow. His eyes were perfectly accustomed to the darkness, yet they were not what they had been. One had been damaged in battle. My solitary point in common with Nelson, he'd once said when half seas over, and had blushed for it afterwards. It was Jan who cried, "There she is! Just a little more forward, sir." And presently Jack caught it, a rhythmic whiteness that travelled from left to right in time with the moderate roll of the ship. "Now, sir," said Jan, when they'd contemplated this for a while, "if we steer southeast, we should come as near as I dare take you to Dogleg Cove in half an hour." "Thank you, pilot," said Jack. "Lie to, if you please, when we are as close in as you think fit. I shall take my measures." He climbed out of the top with the nonchalant ease of one to whom shrouds and ratlins were as natural a path as a flight of stairs, and walked along the dark, silent gangway aft. In the cabin, its lamp hidden from without by deadlights, he found Stephen and Bernard playing chess. Stephen frowned. Bernard made as though to get up, but Jack begged him to remain seated and finish the game. There was perhaps half an hour left. "Shall we call it a draw?" asked Bernard after what seemed to Jack an endless pause of the most intense concentration. "Never in life," said Stephen. "Let me record the position, and with the blessing we shall play it out another day." "Stephen," said Jack, "have you any messages, requests, letters you should like me to send?" Before action, he and Stephen usually exchanged wills and the like. "Not this time, my dear, I thank you very kindly. Lawrence holds all 3 farthings I possess, and dear Diana knows just what I should wish." "Then perhaps we should think of getting ready. The ship will heave to in a very little while. The sea is still, and for the moment, fairly smooth. And although you'll be 15 minutes before your time, I'd sooner set you both ashore with dry coats upon your backs and..." "Come in." It was a midshipman. "Mr. Harding's duty, sir, and there's a light on shore, winking 3 times, then 1. Stephen nodded and said, "Let's go." Their meagre baggage was already in the boat. Jack led them across the darkened deck, absurdly hand in hand, helped them into the cutter, and leaning down grasped Stephen's shoulder with an iron grip by way of farewell. He heard the sheaves turn smoothly. "Handsomely, handsomely," murmured the boatswain. Saw the boat touch and bob. Bondon shoved off. Jack called, "Row dry there," and watched the cutter pull away towards the still winking light.
When at last it went out, he turned from the rail, gave the orders that would carry the Bellona to her anchorage, and went below, deeply sad. He'd seen Stephen off like this many and many a time, but his grief and anxiety never grew less. As he went, he noticed a dim star or two in the zenith, and by the time the boat rejoined with Bondon's report that there was a parcel of gents on the beach talking foreign, but right glad to see the doctor, carried him and his mate ashore dry foot. There was a fine sprinkling of them with Saturn in the middle, and they so clear and sharp that their light showed him not only the now much greater surf breaking on the reef south of the Ile de Seine, but the black, rugged outline of the island itself.